Welcome to The Morning Voice, and I'm Ted Maxwell, your host. I've got Matt Neely behind the glass, as always, keeping us on time and target. When we opened The Morning Voice last week, we talked about the first hour would probably be a little bit more political, a little bit more discussions on what's going on in activities. Well, we're flipping it today. We're going to start off bright and early with the engagement hour. But first, I got to say, Matt, let's just keep it out there. The cats came through last night.
They did. They got a halftime lead to stick. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't looking good as the game wound down, but they made it stick.
We'll take it. I read one thing out in the Twitterverse or the Xverse or whatever we're calling it now last night that made a lot of sense for all the complaining that was going on throughout the game where it looked like they were starting to slow down towards the end and everything. If you had talked to us 2 months ago and said we were going to be 12-3 in the Big 12.
Sure. It didn't look like it was headed that direction, did it?
Who would have said, No, I don't believe that or I won't take that? Yeah. I mean, 12-3 in that conference, which I believe is, and we talked about it when we first announced the Big 12 for the U of A. We said this was going to be the premier basketball conference.
Very competitive conference.
And I think it's proven out to be such. Utah beat Kansas State last night.
Oh, I didn't even see that. That's news to me. Okay. That's how it is.
All right. Well, enough of our sports network for the opening of the morning show as we slowly, our passions bleed into that. I'm really honored today, for those of you who don't know, the Navy's in town. Now, a lot of times, you know, that can be troubling when people say, hey, the Navy's in town, look out. The folks are coming off the boats and the ships. It's going to be a good time. But I think it's going to be an incredible week, and I'm very honored to have a couple of the leaders of the efforts here to talk to us about what Navy Week is and talk to us about why they got engaged and joined the military. So I'm pleased to introduce Commander Tom Deegan, and I hope I got that right. I guess we talked for the last 15 minutes. I'd even ask how to pronounce your name. So that's Commander Tom Deegan. He's the commander of the PCU, Arizona. And there's a great story. We'll talk about that. It's the first, I think everything's called a ship, even a submarine.
Yeah, warship, yeah.
Yeah, you've got to get some of the Air Force out of me on this one. Be the commander of the first ship since the USS Arizona was sunk in Pearl Harbor. So this has got a great story, a big story to it, so I can't wait to break into that. Commander Deegan's a 2005 graduate of Penn State University, so it's probably a little athletics but you could easily talk as well, but we'll stay away from that. Also got his a master's degree from Old Dominion, and he's a 2021-22 fellow of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or as most of us know, that MIT seminar program in National Security and Studies. So a long career, and we're going to get into that real quick after this, sir, with what brought you to the Navy and what you work, but he, like all good commanders, knows the most important person to find is the most senior enlisted member that you can get to work with you, and they will keep you straight and out of trouble. So I'm also honored to have, and I'm just going to keep it as Master Chief. If you want to give me the entire title of how the rank works, I always love the Navy because I'm going ETVCMSS/SW/AW, Dave Jackson. Today it's going to be Master Chief Dave Jackson. He joined the Navy in February of 2001, started his career serving on a carrier, so we'll probably go back and talk a little bit about that. And he's got a long and distinguished career, which sounds like maybe coming to an end here shortly, so I may give you an opportunity to talk about that. Well, and appreciate you being with us today, as well as Master Chief. Look forward to hearing some of your thoughts and what Navy Week means to you and what the Navy's meant to you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And like all good things, when you send a leadership team out, you make sure you bring somebody to keep them on track. So you're also going to hear the voice of Lieutenant Commander
Miranda Williams. Yes.
Yeah, I wrote it down and then I went to my opening intro, which I didn't even use, and I didn't come back to it. Sometimes this radio stuff still throws me off. So and appreciate you being here and look forward to, you're kind of the expert on what Navy Week's about, and we'll have some conversation with you about that and hear more about your career as well. Mm-hmm. So I thank all three of you for joining us today. Part of the engagement hour is trying to get people involved in their communities, and there's so many different ways to do it. You know, we're a nation bound by shared values, freedoms, liberty, and equality, and with that comes some rights and responsibilities. I always talk, sometimes service is really obvious. those who serve in public safety, those who serve in the military, you know, the health first responders. And there's a lot of different ways people serve. But I personally enjoy coming back and talking to those who have served in the military. But the big question is, why? So, Commander, why don't we start with you? What was it that got you interested in joining the military, and what led you to that? I mean, you're at Penn State, going to college. What got you in the service?
All right, great, yeah. Number one, thank you for having us on today. It's an honor to be here in Tucson. For me, it's, I think, a similar story for some people, but a little different. I'm kind of third generation Navy. My dad was a submariner for 30 years, retired 06 in the submarine force. And then, so I grew up kind of moving around, but I was lucky to grow up in Pearl Harbor or the Oahu in Hawaii for, as a child until I was about 11, and then mainly the DC area after that. We moved around some other places too, but, so I had that influence, and he's a great guy. I could have been whatever I wanted in life. He never really pressured me to do anything, but I saw the service, and I saw the giving back and the military service kind of, up front. And I was also lucky to go on three dependence cruises as a kid. So I went underway on submarines three different times before I graduated high school. So that's a lot different from anybody. But so I had that, I had those seeds growing up kind of thing. And then, I went to, Penn State, did Navy ROTC at Penn State. Kind of similar to Arizona State University and University of Arizona, both have Navy ROTC. So did that, and then I then went submarines there. So, I think it was, it's kind of the message of really the why, though. I mean, those are the influences I had, but the why, what really attracted me was just the hard job, the service, but also the reward of the service, the going around, seeing the world, doing something greater than yourself, being a part of a really strong team, and really the people too. Because the people, the American sailor is the heart of the Navy, and we remain the most powerful Navy in the world, and attracting and retaining a talented force of 335,000 people from all over the country. And that's what we see on our unit. We are the pre-commissioning unit, Arizona, which is just a fancy term to say the future USS Arizona. So it's just kind of a caveat the Navy gives you until you're a commissioned vessel, because we're coming from Groton, Connecticut, where we're being built by Electric Boat. So it's really nice to be in Southern Arizona in February. It was snowing when we flew out.
I'm glad you got out.
Yeah, we were delayed. We had to be de-iced in the, at the airport prior to taking off, but super happy to be in Tucson to experience Navy Week and kind of tell America really about why the Navy is such a wonderful organization to be a part of. Cobb here, we call him the Cobb, he's the chief of the boat. So Master Chief Jackson and I have been in for a long time. And number one, we joined the Navy, but then we stayed in the Navy, and with no regrets kind of thing. And it's been an adventure. It's been fun, but it's also been hard work. And that, I welcome the hard work. You got to welcome the hard work, because that's where you get the satisfaction and it means something. So,
Well, and you just hit 20 years this year, and you've already shared with me that it's not the end for you.
So not yet.
And if you want to talk about hard work, Commander Diggins' next assignment will be at the Pentagon, which that's something I've always said, especially as an officer who's got so much experience as you do actually in the service and under the water and on top of the water and working with the men and women who are serving out there actively. It's always bittersweet, but it's something you've got to do, and it's something that's important, but it is a lot of hard work, and hopefully you'll enjoy your time at the Pentagon.
Yeah, it's...
Have you been there before?
I have. I got to work at Office of Secretary of Defense prior to this tour, actually, so got to do that. That was a very unique job, but it's a little bit more bureaucratic in the Pentagon, but it's a needed thing. It's like, how do you keep the world's greatest military running? And yeah, it's training, it's tactical, it's getting underway on submarines, or it's doing all the little different parts of the military, but it's also making sure the all the machinations of the Pentagon are also working. It's a huge organization. So,
Commander, great job answering a question where I'm trying to put you on the spot about having to go back and not be operational. So that's great. Master Chief, before we go to our break, I want to also hear from you on why. Now, ironically, you joined the service in 2001. And so everybody says, oh, 2001. They all assume they know why you joined. But the fact of the matter is you joined in February 2001. So can you kind of tell us your journey and your story and how you made that decision to join the Navy?
Yeah, absolutely. Mine is wildly different than Commander Deegan's here. So I'm originally from Denver, Colorado. I grew up there as a young man. I was a little restless. So I had some unique opportunities, and I got up and I moved to Boston one month and found some roommates, lived in Boston for about a year, and I could not find what I needed. So I decided to join the military, just kind of on a whim. Like, I'm going to get out of here. I want some world adventures. So the funny thing is, and what I like to tell people is, I went to the Army, and I went to open their door, and it was locked. And the Navy guy popped his head out, and he's like, hey, can I help you? And so...
That's good.
So I walked into his office, and, you know, 24 years later, I don't regret it. It's been an awesome decision. I found what kind of drives me. I've seen the world. I've been to over 30 countries.
That's amazing.
And traveled all the way around the globe. It was the adventure that I wanted. So it's been good to me for the last 24 years. And, you know, as you previously mentioned, I have about a year left, and then I'll be getting out of the Navy. It's a milestone. It's nice.
You already know what you're going to do, or
oh no, much yeah. Like most people getting out of the Navy a year out, I have no clue what I'm going to do. It's fantastic, but this is a young person's sport, and I'm no longer that young person, so it's good. Like, I'll move on, and it allows somebody else the opportunity to move up to where I am and to take over and to do the challenges that I've done.
Well, like I mentioned earlier, as a young cadet when I was on my Operation Noncom, where we went and spent 3 weeks in the summer, working amongst the enlisted force, everyone I met there said those prophetic words is, find yourself the most senior enlisted member and hook yourself to their hip when you're a young lieutenant or a captain. And I'll tell you more, as a senior officer, you've got to do it. What's it like to be the cob, the chief of the boat?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. The way I've described this in the past is I am both the HR representative for the boat, and I'm also the principal. So it's a lot of people that, you know, as you said, find yourself the most senior person. There's a lot of life skills that I teach young men and women on how to deal with, you know, how to buy their first car, how to, you know, they're like, I think I want to get married. Awesome. That's a major decision. And since, you know, a lot of us have seen this where you have a spouse in the military and they've met a military member, and it's like, now there are some challenges, but are you going to be stationed together? Because that puts a whole new dynamic in there. So we have, you know, I have to know all the opportunities to and all the resources to give the sailors. So, and we have specialized people for everything, financial aid, marriage counseling, like they just walk through all the things. So these young men and women, like they face a lot of challenges, and a lot of them are in the same situation I was in, right? A little lost in the world, not knowing what to do, not knowing how to do it. And so my job is to guide them in the right direction and to teach people how to do that so we can teach ourselves how to take care of ourselves.
Well, you think about all the things the skill sets that you've had to develop in order to get to the rank and to the position you've got right now. Don't worry, in a year you'll be fine. A lot of people are asking you to come work for them. You'll
That's
be
right.
good. So no need to enjoy your last year as much as possible. And as it gets closer, you'll figure something out.
He'll move to Tucson. It's nice down here.
Connecticut, Tucson. I get it.
Zero ice storms while I'm here.
Yeah, you can stay a long time, and you probably will see zero ice storms, so that's great. So before we head to the break, and I want to make sure to introduce Lieutenant Commander Williams and get your story and how you came to the service. And I believe your spouse, you said, is also military. So
unfortunately, my ex-spouse. But talking to what Cobb was saying, it is very challenging in the military. And we had
very
a lot
difficult.
Of resources. He was a Marine Corps. I'm very proud of his service as well. We're still friends. But I came into the Navy at 17 in 1994. And I will be retiring this year. I wanted to be a journalist, and I got to do that in the Navy for 14 years. I have been on a hospital ship, aircraft carriers. I worked at the White House. I've had some amazing opportunities. And now this year I'll retire in November. I'll have done 31 years, and it has been a ride. It's been outstanding. It's been wonderful. No regrets for my time in the Navy.
And what was the reason you joined?
I joined because I had almost all of my aunts and uncles were in a service, Air Force, Navy, Army, not Marine Corps. But my aunt, my uncle, who were in the Navy, I just loved their stories. And I said, I want to be like that. And I also really admired Connie Chung. And so I wanted to be a journalist. And the Navy let me do that.
And it's worked out great. And for those who may not understand, the 31 years started as an enlisted member of the Navy, and you transitioned some point in there to the officer corps, and now as a lieutenant commander, you've done extremely well. So thank you for being here, and I'm looking forward to these stories. If we've got any Navy folks out there that want to pitch in with their stories or have questions, please call us today, 520-790-2040. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about the USS Arizona, and we'll go down what it means to the both of you about being so impactful and critical role of getting the opportunity for the Arizona to get back in the water. You're listening to 1030 The Voice. This is Trusted Local News and Talk. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. And if you can't tell, the Navy's in town. So hang on. I really appreciate having Lieutenant Commander Tom Diggin, Master Chief Dave Jackson, and Commander Tom Diggin. Don't want to demote you when you're getting ready to go to the Pentagon. There's got to be better future in your career than that. Otherwise, you might be joining the Master Chief looking for a job. And then Lieutenant Commander Miranda Williams as well is with us, making sure the two of them stay on point and do it well. I want to take this section and talk about the USS Arizona. It's an incredible story. I mean, it took you no time when we sat down to talk about the history of the Arizona and how proud you both are to be involved in this. So let's talk about the status of the submarine, as far as just, you know, people won't understand what a PCU is and vice versa. What are your roles and what are you excited about being part of bringing the USS Arizona back to the waters, defending our country?
Yeah, no, it's great to be, we both were very excited to get orders to Arizona when we got it. For me, well, first of all, we're a fast attack submarine being built in Groton, Connecticut, and by Electric Boat, one of the best shipbuilder for submarines in the world. It's neat because we're a Virginia class fast attack submarine, but we're a new version. So you take they've made about 25 Virginia class fast attack submarines already, but you take one of those, you cut it in half, you add an 84 foot section in it, in the middle of the submarine, and you fill it with Tomahawk missiles. That's what the Arizona is going to be. So it triples the amount of Tomahawks we can have on board. So it triples the lethality of our fast attack submarine. And it'll be, once commissioned, it will be the most lethal fast attack submarine ever built. And we're the first one for it. There's going to be more after us, but we're the first one. And so that's huge.
So 84 feet. You're adding 84 feet to length. So what's the total length?
It's roughly about 460 feet. Okay. Give or take. So they
and when it's fully operational, how many sailors will you have on board?
We should have about 130 to 135.
About that, yeah.
Okay, that's so incredible.
So that number one is just like unique in general for just if you into nerding out in submarines because it's like, hey, a first of a kind, a lot of Tomahawks, and you know, just that'll be really good. I mean, it's great for the defense of America. Another a highly capable asset to use all over the world when called upon by America. So really excited to get that in the water. So that's number one, why we're important and special. But number two, also the great state of Arizona, super patriotic state. We've been here, been a couple trips down to Arizona now, and it's just always just a fascinating state. Lots of good stuff here. It's growing. It's both Phoenix and Tucson and the Grand Canyon, Flagstaff, like every part of Arizona. That's we want that as part of kind of our culture on board, because that's what we are. And and that leads us to, we are the first warship named Arizona in over 83 years, since December 7th of 1941, and where the battleship BB-39 was you know, attacked in Pearl Harbor, and has the beautiful Arizona Memorial now in Pearl Harbor. That day, 1,177 sailors passed in that attack, the largest amount of sailors died on the Arizona that day. Many commands in the attack of Pearl Harbor, but Arizona took the biggest toll. And that legacy, honoring the legacy in the sailors, is one of the honor of my career. And it's super important for us to do that. And we've been, since we manned up about 2 years ago, as a command, we've been able to do that a lot. So some special moments we've had have been December 7th, definitely. 2 years ago, or December 7th of 2023, we were able to go to Arlington National Cemetery in D.C. and lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in honor of the sailors on from the battleship Arizona. Because most of the 1,177 that died that day, a lot of them are still entombed on board, because it was such a massive explosion in Pearl Harbor. And then there's about 88 that are at the Punch Bowl Cemetery, the Pacific Cemetery for the on Oahu there, and they're unidentified. So that's why it was such a special moment to lay the wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier on the National Cemetery on December 7th of 2023. And then this past year was our first command trip to the Arizona Memorial on December 7th, 2024. So, you know, we're pretty popular on that day as the next Arizona, but those are two events we've done. We've also done events like in Rhode Island and Connecticut for different towns and stuff like that. And then actually this in the past year, the last remaining survivor on board the battleship Arizona passed away, Mr. Lou Contour, last April. And I was honored to be able to go to his funeral in Grass Valley, California, and be one of two people to take the flag, you know, over the casket and give it to his surviving daughter. So I'd be a part of that. So just to honor the past and to take that legacy and have it part of our culture on board, super important.
And with that, we're going to leave that as the tease. When we come back after the bottom of the hour break, we'll talk more about the Arizona. You're listening to 1030 The Voice. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass. And we have been engaged by the Navy. And we've had a great conversation so far on the USS Arizona. And I don't want to cut it short. During the break, we were talking about how sometimes it's hard when you are literally guiding the future now of a namesake, a ship that has history. So there's always challenges with that, because some people, I think, want to let that go. But I think there's more to the story about why it's important for the USS Arizona to be back on the water. Either one of you want to?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's we're not just we don't consider ourselves not just another submarine, just another state name. We consider ourselves, we are also, that identity is Great State Arizona, but it's the first warship named Arizona since the battleship, and that's important. And that is not just, hey, fly-by-night, isn't that an interesting fact? It's, what we love about it, it's a wonderful, it's been, you know, over 83 years, and it's, we're going to remember them, we want to remember them forever, and I think using the name again, Arizona, in us, as the submarine, it definitely continues that legacy. It doesn't fade away. That memory continues throughout. We're gonna, you know, train everybody. We train our crew on the battleship Arizona, and we don't want it to go away. We try really hard to make sure we do it right. To honor them, to honor the state. And that's all we could do is I think we're doing pretty good on it. But we do ask that question, are we doing enough kind of thing every day? And it's important.
Yeah, I think the first thing that we did and we had the honor of doing was creating our crest, right? So every ship has its crest. And one of the things that we found very important to include is we wanted to include what America knows as the Arizona, which is the memorial, right? It's a beautiful white, I believe it's marble building, that sits atop of where the Arizona is at rest in Pearl Harbor. So we included that in our crest.
Nice.
And, you know, another aspect is that we actually included the ship, which is the shadow of our submarine. And we wanted to make sure that we honored both the memorial, because that's what we know is the Arizona. But there's also, you know, the memorial's there for a reason. That's because of the ship and the men and women that, you know, laid their life down in defense of the country. Even unknowingly at that time, nobody woke up that morning thinking they were going to be attacked. But in the end that, you know, a lot of people lost their lives, and that's, we wanted to tie that into our crest. And so we were able to honor both of the ship and the memorial by putting them in our crest. So,
and I think that's important for the men and women who are going to serve on the USS Arizona when it gets its full name. I guess it has to come out of the PCU status.
Yeah, once we get commissioned, name, and
you get the USS. It's important for them to know that history and from that traditional part. But I think it's important to remember that those who did perish that day, they would probably be proud to know that there is a boat named, sorry, boat ship. My father-in-law was a retired two-star admiral, and he used to always, we'd sit there and I'd say boat just for fun most of the time, but he'd always correct me, ship. But it wasn't until I was retiring a chief master sergeant at the Guard, who I was talking about him serving on a boat in Vietnam, and from the stage he goes, "Ship, sir." And I went, "There it is. I got to start getting that." So ship. But I think they'll be proud to know, and they'd want that name to live on in their legacy. It's not just about their memory. The families, obviously, you're going to run into some folks that want that to be the same. But even their generations, their families, the best way for them to know about what their great-grandfather, their great-great-grandparent that served is going to be through the stories you will be able to continue to tell and live through the current day USS Arizona. So I really appreciate you sharing all those stories with us. But I got to ask you one thing. Submarines. What's it like? I mean, you had a Commander Diggin, you had a family legacy, so you kind of knew, and you got to take some family. What's it really like living on a submarine?
I think it's great.
It's 138 people in 480 feet long, even on the big ones. On the older ones that you've probably done some of your cruises on, might even be smaller.
So that's the external length, right? The internal length, where the people tank, as we call it, right?
The people tank.
So you keep water out of the people tank. That's how we stay safe. The inside is it's a lot smaller. So, you know, you have an engine room. That's where work gets done. You have a forward compartment. That's where we live. We eat. We train. We drive the boat. We combat anything is from the forward end. You know, one thing that's unique and a lot of people ask us is, you know, where do people sleep? We sleep in very tiny racks, we call them. We have 119 on board. And, you know, when you start to break it down, it comes down to about 80 for the crew. And the crew makes up about 110 people.
80 racks, you mean?
80 racks. So we have what's called hot racking, which means that we share racks with people. So three people will get two racks. And then as one gets out to take the watch, another gets in. So it's always a hot rack. So that's why that's where that name comes from. It's a unique experience. And, you know, we have about five or six cooks in general. And they're making three meals a day, every day, for 6-7 months at a time. And that's... and serving all of those people. So they're making thousands of meals a day, and it's just an enormous responsibility. And these are 18, 19, 20-year-olds that are learning how to do this. And that's the amazing part, is that you have such a young group of people that just take on this massive amount of responsibility and do so with great pride.
We make our own air, we make our own water, we make our own electrical power, we go all over the world. There's a lot of people that think that's like, hey, I think I'd be claustrophobic on a submarine. It's like, no, it's just like being inside. You're inside and you're underway, and it's nice actually, because let's say it's bad sea states, you just go deep, and this is the weather is 72 and fluorescent every day.
and Commander Diggin, you're tall. You're not
6'2". I'm fine. You learn where the low spots are, and you avoid. So
I'm gonna ask each of you a favorite submarine memory. What story sticks in your mind?
Wow, I think deployments, just the camaraderie building.
Yeah.
So you have a crew, right? And anybody that's been in the Navy would, I'm sure, back this story up, right? A crew is a crew until you deploy, And then you really become a unit. You become a family. You start to look out for each other. That's when you really start to really earn lifelong friends. And those are the moments, I think, that are most important. Deployments, it's 6 to 8 months, 9 to 10 if you're on a carrier. Hands down, they're not that fun. But you get to see the world. So you have an adventure. Being away from, you know, your wife, your kids, that's the part that sucks. But seeing the world, that's what you join the Navy for, and that's what people really enjoy. And in the end, you know, like when I retire and I get out and people ask me, I won't ever remember the parts that I disliked. I will always remember
statement.
The parts.
That is so true.
Yeah. You know, you brag about the things that you did that were fun and exciting. Being to 30 countries, that's something amazing. That's the interesting part, I think.
Yeah, and it's just that feeling of like, you know, someone's got to be on watch. And the Navy, you know, since we're on the water, we're always, you know, for these deployments that we say, it's like, hey, we're not just off the coast of, you know, Virginia or something like that. We go all over the world. We are forward. We have a forward presence there. You know, we have two huge oceans on both sides of our country here, and we are a critical role in safeguarding our maritime boundaries and stuff like that. So it's just protecting the American way of life and above and below the sea. So, and we do a lot of missions vital to national security we don't talk about, but it's a really cool experience. So
the amazing part is people forget that the Navy truly is the power projection.
Yes.
Of our military. You know, you have to pack the Air Force up. You have to pack the Army up. We can't be there immediately. You're always there. And like you said, sometimes you're not where anybody can see you.
On purpose.
Exactly. Right. So that always leaves the doubt in those who may want to do harm to us or have other regional aspirations. They don't know if you're there or not. And so that, to me, is an amazing thing. Total number, if you got it off the top of your heads, of the cruises you've taken.
How many deployments have we done?
Yep. Because you just mentioned how long they are. People sometimes don't realize that.
I've been on 4 deployments. The longest time underway without ventilating was 92 days.
92 days under the water.
Non-ventilating. Yeah, right.
Non-ventilating means to us laymen, you haven't surfaced.
Right, yeah.
Well, that means
no fresh air.
Yeah, no fresh air. That's
We make our own air. Air is good as God's. It's good.
So. 92 days. Oh, man.
Yeah. I've been on
Master
7
Chief?
Deployments.
Okay.
So, and
it's a heck of a career.
Several surge deployments, which are just like smaller deployments that you do.
Right.
But yeah, you get to see the world. That's the fun part for me.
All right, we're going to take a break here because when we get back, I want to talk about Navy Week. I want to get Lieutenant Commander Williams involved in this conversation as she knows what you're doing. I know your schedule's busy. We appreciate you here. We appreciate your service and look forward to continuing the conversation. If you do want to call in, 520-790-2040. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, your host. We're joined by Commander Tom Deegan, Master Chief Dave Jackson, and I'm going to turn the microphone over now to Lieutenant Commander Miranda Williams. They're here in Tucson with a lot more of the Navy than you might know. There's numerous events they're going to be going to throughout the week to kind of tell the Navy story. But Lieutenant Commander, what is the purpose of Navy Week?
Yeah, so we are very excited to be in Tucson and bringing the 5th Navy Week to Tucson that has been here since our program started in 2005. Navy Weeks were born out of the fact that, unfortunately, a lot of people in the U.S. just didn't know what their Navy did. And we're not inland, right? We're on ships, so we're on the coast. So what we do is, since 2005, every year, we bring to 15 cities around the U.S., we have a Navy Week, and we're here to meet with the community. We are here to inform and educate and help you to just understand not only the importance of the Navy, but see who your sailors are. What are they doing? Hearing their stories. And we think that that's really important because a lot of people don't know, you know, our Navy's track record of keeping America safe, it's just so sound that most Americans can't recall a time in their lives when they feared attack from another nation's naval force. And that's because of your Navy. And so Navy Week, we have anywhere from 50 to 75 events that we're doing in Tucson. In fact, some of those, we hope that you will come out and see us. We're going to be at the rodeo. We're also going to be, there's a, at Reed Park, there's going to be a Navy Day at the zoo. So please come out. If you see us in uniform or you see us in our polos with our Navy logos, talk to us. We want to tell you about your Navy. We want to answer your questions, maybe share some sea stories, and just, yeah, interact with the public.
So it's not just, we've got the commanders of the USS Arizona with us, but it's not just name affiliations. You also bring back members of the Navy who grew up in Tucson, as I understand.
Yes, yes. We have some hometown heroes. In fact, we were at Amphitheater High School yesterday, and we had some of those hometown sailors. They were able to interact with the students there. One of them was a graduate of Amphitheater just a couple of years ago. And in addition to that, we have Navy Band. We have Navy Esports. For people who don't know what that is, that's like video games. We also have some sailors from the USS Constitution, so they wear the more traditional uniform that we wore in, when our Navy was founded. We have Vice Admiral James Pitts, who's here, and he's meeting with many members of the community. We also have the Vietnam War commemoration. One of the things that we recognize is when we're talking about legacy, we want to thank our Vietnam veterans, welcome them home. And that is also what we'll be doing at a lot of the events, is talking with our veterans, hearing their sea stories, and again, thanking them for their service.
That is one thing I try to do every time I speak publicly, is to make sure I thank them. They did not get the welcome home, mm-hmm. and it's their service that has allowed all of us to serve without ever having anybody question it. It was like the Vietnam Wars, where we learned that you can love the warrior but hate the war. You don't have to like what's going on, but it's not because of the men and women who choose to stand up and serve. So I think that's really important. I want to highlight one of them for sure. If on the 19th of February you're going out to the city of Oro Valley for a Navy Week proclamation and Vietnam Veteran Recognition Ceremony, and I believe that's going to be held at the new Heroes Memorial that they put up there. It's just, I live in Oro Valley, for full disclosure, so I might be a little biased, but that has been a long, hard work for so many people to make that a reality, and it is really quite an impressive place. So I appreciate you going out there, and like you said, I think you're going to have a couple days out at the rodeo. So there's a lot of opportunity to interact with the men and women that are coming to represent the Navy here in Arizona. I'm pretty sure we'll be recognizing some Navy heroes of the game at the Arizona basketball game Saturday. So I hope you all get out and see that one. It's another big one, and we are a sports fanatic town. So thank you for being here and making sure that people recognize it. Now, how much recruiting comes out of it? Are you able to attract people? Do you think this is not just telling the Navy story and letting the American go, but do you have an opportunity to inspire those men and women who maybe don't know what they want to do, like Master Chief, to lead to an opportunity that can give them an incredible lifetime career of service and really add a lot to their life?
Yes. So while we are not recruiters, and the office that I work for is the Navy Office of Community Outreach, what we are doing is outreach. But we have recruiters here in the area. They are absolutely at some of our events. And we do hope that we might inspire the new generation, right? As we said, Master Chief and I are getting out this year. We want to see that next generation coming in. And so we do hope that we can set a positive condition for recruiting, that the family members can ask us those hard questions. What is it really like being in the Navy? Should I, you know, send my son and daughter off into the Navy? And we want to give them those honest answers. We are testaments of long careers, had fun in the Navy. And so we do hope that we can inspire the people who will fill our shoes when we're gone.
Oh, I have no doubt you will, and I know that's good, and I appreciate the three of you being here. We've got about a minute left, so I want to, Master Chief, 30 seconds. Final thoughts?
Yeah, thank you. I think one important thing is, you know, Lieutenant Commander and I, we have both been in the Navy for a long time, but the Navy doesn't need people who want to sign up for 20, 30 years.
Oh,
they
absolutely
need people to sign up to get advanced training. You know, we have a lot of 21-year-olds operating nuclear reactors, and then they get out after one enlistment or, you know, a period of time. That is what we need as well. We need that long-term and short-term. So it's important, like, you don't need to come in for 30 years. That's something you don't need to sign up for at 20, but you decide as you go along.
But that opportunity is there if it suits you. But it's a great point.
Absolutely.
It's not that. Commander Diggin.
Yeah, and thanks to the people at Tucson. It's like, hey, we are your Navy. It's not just, hey, the Navy's not something separate somewhere else. It's like, we are your Navy. We want to talk to you about it, and we want to make sure that, you know, this. If you do want to serve, like, we'll talk to you about it, and hopefully you do. You know, and super thankful for the city of Tucson for helping us out. Looking forward to the Roadrunners game coming up. And yeah, we'll be at Oro Valley. That'll be special. Looking forward to that event as well.
Well, we greatly appreciating all three of you being here with us today. Thank you for your service. And I'll say it, go Navy.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us, Tucson.
Right, we'll be back after the break and talk a little more politics. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass. And we just had an hour spent talking U.S. Navy. Very, very impressive group of men and women that came in and joined us this morning. And
Navy.
It's there. And they've taken over Tucson. And I strongly encourage people, you can get, just search Tucson Navy Week, and you will find all the activities that are going out. Try to find an opportunity to go out and support them. They do an incredible job serving our country, and they've come out here to spend a week with us telling the Navy stories. And I hope if you didn't listen, I'd ask you to go back and listen.
Because the podcast up real soon. Oh, that's good.
Because, Matt, that was the whole conversation around the USS Arizona and the importance of bringing that namesake back to the waters defending our country. I thought the way they laid it out, what they talked about, and the respect they have, understanding they will be the first USS Arizona back on the waters and what's required for them. So it was I thought it was a good hour. I enjoyed it. And now, as a shift, that Navy call came from my guest host this morning as we wait for hopefully Stephen Richard to call in, the former Maricopa County recorder, to talk about the purpose and some of the challenges of off-cycle elections. But I've got Josh Jacobson with me today. Josh, infamous for being, I guess,
Lots of things, right?
But he's got Lucky Wishbone. He runs another. If you're eating anything fried in this town, there's a good chance Josh and his company's had a mark on it. But more importantly, Josh, it's your engagement. That's what I think people have come in. You've become very active in the community. Obviously, Tucson Crime Free Coalition has kind of elevated that and that with your 8,000 plus members.
And growing, and thanks to audiences like yours, Ted. And I wanted to actually back to the Navy real quick. You know, one of my long-term GMs has a daughter that joined the Navy, and she's been in for a few years now. And so I hear what it's like to be on those ships. But I got to tell you, there is no way I am getting on a submarine. That would scare the daylights out of me. No, thank you. I am so glad that we have people that are willing to do that work, because not this guy.
92 days. Commander Diggin was 92 days without surfacing at one point.
No, thank you.
I mean, I just, that's just beyond. I spent 56 hours on a carrier, and that's big.
Yeah.
And I was ready to get off.
Yeah.
So you've got to really respect the folks that go out and do that. And we need them there, because those submarines quite often are where nobody knows they are, and they always keep everybody guessing. And then you put the carriers on board, which is another one that they're at sea for a long time. Yep. And that's a show of force and a show of power. And we use that quite effectively to try to keep areas calm. So it's amazing.
It's one of our biggest tools of our military might across the world, because we can deploy from nearly anywhere, right? So that you know, the other crazy people like you can get up in the airplanes and go and do whatever needs to be done.
Yeah, the flying part's actually a lot of fun. But
I could get on board with.
But even I've got several hours flying over Iraq, and even then, there's something about being that far away from it, you know. And but the Navy gets right into it. The Army, the Marines, they're right into it. There's something about being above the ground that kind of it doesn't. You know you're there,
right?
You know what could happen and what could be going on. But most of the time you're just, it's a sense of security being that far above the ground where all the bad things are happening.
All the bad things are happening. But does it come into your mind too, clearly you're above the ground, but does it come into your mind that you are not anywhere near our guys? You mean you have people flying with you, but you are over hostile country. Does that come into it as well?
The first time you do it's an eye opener.
Yeah.
And especially when you're doing it at night.
Oh yeah.
At 12, 2 o'clock in the morning, it's you start watching your engine instruments really closely, especially in a single engine aircraft.
Oh, I bet.
You all of a sudden you go back and you explain to the crew chief, hey, my oil gauge was doing this, and they go, sir, it does that every flight.
Right.
It's just something you've never noticed until you're in that
uh-huh.
scenario.
I
really appreciate the fact that the Navy wants to come out here. They want to put on their best. There's gonna be a lot of opportunities. If you look at the list, again, just search Tucson Navy Week and you can find all their activities. There are so many Vietnam veteran recognitions that they're doing, being going to be part of.
Yeah.
And that is such a big deal because the Vietnam vets were not always welcomed home.
And we have a ton of vets in this community.
And there's a zillion. And it's important for us to remember that and tell them, welcome home.
Right.
Because what they did has changed the vision on service. People forget back in Vietnam, it was still a draft.
Mm-hmm. I registered for the draft when I...
Absolutely.
Registered
well, you still have to register.
Yeah.
There, you still have to in case we bring it back.
I heard that was done. I didn't know that they were still doing that.
I think that...
Or maybe it's like jury duty. You just
do it and you avoid it. But the fact of the matter is people forget now we are... Yeah. Our military, unlike a lot of the militaries in the world, is all voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
And we are still having young men and women who are willing to step up and serve. Some, like, Master Chief was talking about, he didn't know what he was going to do, so I'm going to join the military. He had other people that joined the military that knew, and it's turned into an amazing career for him.
Oh, 100%. Some of the kids that I went to school with, high school with, we never thought, these kids were nuts, but they ended up joining the military. They got vocations. They went on to do amazing things, or even in some instances, we had some kids that joined ROTC. And then went into the military as an officer and then went into medical. I've got a friend that's an ophthalmologist paid for by the United States Air Force, retired as a colonel. And now he's got his own ophthalmology practice and the guy's just killing it.
And if you go into some of those fields, you can continue to serve in the the Guard or the Reserve part-time.
Right.
And start establishing your practice and setting up. There's so many opportunities that the military can provide you. It's not for everybody. I'm not ever going to say that everybody should do it. It's made for everybody. It's not.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but
that's life.
But you will learn skills that employers like yourself value. Showing up on time, being ready to work, and then it gives you so many opportunities. That's what the master, it's impressive when somebody's retiring after 24 years for them to go back and mention, listen, it's not just about the career. Yes, you have opportunities if you find it to your liking, but it's about the skill sets you learn, the personal improvements you make.
Sure.
In part because the military makes you, but also because you don't want to disappoint the rest of the people you're working
with. Right. And yeah. And how many years were you in, Ted?
My total was 34 years. I did 29 years full-time and then 5 years. And I loved every minute of it. I think that's the other thing I got a sense from them sharing their stories. They've loved every minute of it.
Right.
But that's not really literally every minute of it.
Sure.
There are times.
Oh,
anything. It's
characters create an adversity, right?
Absolutely. So you came on to join me because we want to talk about something going on in the city of Tucson right now.
Oh, I thought it was just because you liked me, but okay. What do you want to talk about, Tad?
Of course we like you, Josh. Gosh.
And I miss you, Matt. My goodness.
Oh, well, you're always welcome back on this show. Matter of fact, I've got a short list of folks who I want to sit in as the guest host, so I may add you to that list and let you run a couple of these shows in the near future. But let's talk a little Prop 4. 414. I'm hoping Stephen Richard will be able to join us. He's back in Cambridge now. He actually is back there doing a fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
That's Stephen Richard was the former Maricopa County recorder through a lot of things. And he's a very thoughtful and balanced person. I was hoping he'd he might be able to give us some insight into a March election
sure.
and what that means. But let's go back to it. You're heavily engaged in some of the what I would call the collaboration of folks working together on trying to make this campaign. Now that they're not on, because I would never make anybody in the military who's here on, they said they saw signs all over the place.
And I asked really? Them,
well, which signs did you see? They said a ton of the no campaign signs.
I Interesting.
Said, that's good. And they learned about it later last night about what the sales, the proposal, half cent sales tax for the city of Tucson.
Half percent, was about, folks.
Half percent. And their first comment was 9.2%.
Right.
Really?
Imagine if you're a gem show visitor.
They didn't have the detail of what it's going for or anything. And I filled them in on some of that. And they still could not get past the 9.2%.
Right. What do we get for that?
So it's both a little bit of what do we get and who does it impact the most?
Right.
You know, it's easy to say, oh, it's only a half cent. But that's what's gotten it to 9.2. The next will be 9.7 if there's another half cent. And the fact is, as you just brought up, what do we get?
Mm-hmm.
And what difference is it going to make in the community?
Right.
And so what are your concerns?
Well, you know, I was thinking about it on the way down here as I was driving down Alvernon, and my truck was rattling, and I thought that some of my knobs were going to fall off the dash. That, you know, it was a year ago that Tucson Crime Free Coalition, we hosted a film crew that came here to look at the fentanyl epidemic and how the border related to it. And their remark was, you know, we've been all over this country, and these have to be some of the worst roads we've ever been on. And they said that because they were trying to film as I was driving them through some of our arterial streets. And they said, you guys don't even have snow here. So how did this get like this? And so the answer is the Tucson Crime Free Coalition has grave concerns. It's been pointed out recently by the Arizona Daily Star. We did an interview over the weekend that, you know, it's kind of ironic that the Tucson Crime Free Coalition that advocates for adequate staffing and resources for law enforcement, that you guys are coming out against this. How can it be? And the bottom line is, it's just bad policy. And I think that's what the entire community is talking about right now. It's bad policy in the sense that it's way too big. It's way too broad. There's no real oversight. The money can be redirected. And the city has just burnt the bridges of trust of knowing that things are going to get allocated to where they're going to. So just to remind the listeners, when you read the Truth and Taxation document, you can go to the city website, Google 414, and it will take you to the city website, and you'll be able to see on the right side of the screen, there's a bunch of documents. Search for that Truth and Taxation, folks. It's one of the most important things that you can do. And what it says in there, it says it directly, and I'm sure you've said it, Ted, that Proposition 414 money will be used to supplant previous propositions, including 101, 411, ARPA funds, state and general grants. So the point is that they're telling us already that they haven't fulfilled the promise of Prop 101 or Prop 411.
Yeah, that is a big and important issue, and it's not highly visible. But you've got to read the Truth in Taxation because it does allow that. Yeah. You got to be a nerd. Right, you got to enjoy some of this.
Can I just ask one rhetorical question?
Please, Mr. Neely.
Why do we have to vote for the bonds for streets? Why do we have to vote for a tax for streets? Why do we have to vote for a tax for public safety? Why are those the extras that we have to vote for? That's the problem that I have.
Which goes to the basic bottom line.
He says vote for SunTran or something like that, free bus fares.
I think you've hit the point on the head there, Matt. A lot of us have been saying it out loud. It's about setting the priorities in the budget.
Mm-hmm.
The city manager wrote an op-ed this weekend that talked about how they've got great ratings for bonding, okay, but that's not about setting priorities, that they've got all this stuff. What do you want to cut out? We ask the city, council and the mayor to make the decision, what are the priorities for the city of Tucson? Former city manager Mike Ortega used to say, go to your North Star. Your North Star is the charter. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're missing. I know we've got Stephen Richard joining us online now. And I want to bring him in and welcome him. And then, unfortunately, we'll probably be going to a break pretty quick. Stephen, thank you for joining us. I appreciate you. I know there was some confusion with the phone number. Hopefully, I didn't give you a wrong one.
No, it was. I assume it was my fault. So apologies for the delay, but thanks for having me on.
Well, I've always appreciated all the insight. And Stephen Richard, as many of you know, is the former county recorder for Maricopa County, which in the research is the second largest county in the United States when it comes to the number of citizens.
Comes to the number of registered voters, yeah. So we're the fourth largest county in the United States by population, but the second largest in terms of number of voters. And so, and that obviously continues to grow, as does the rest of Arizona, as does the wonderful and beautiful Pima County down where you guys are.
So one of the things, Stephen, that I always ask all my guests is, why did you decide to step into the fray and step into public politics?
Yeah, insanity, I suppose, a measure of. I think it sort of, it takes a little bit of that. You know, I've often said to some of my family members that being in politics is a uniquely selfless and a uniquely selfish thing that you do. It's selfless in that you're foregoing potential salary, you're foregoing focusing on maybe things that will benefit your family directly, and you're instead hopefully working towards a public good. But it's selfless, it's selfish in that it's so all-consuming, and you get wrapped up in it, and you're going out every single night to different events. But I ran because I've long been interested in politics. I've long been a social creature that thought I would be satisfied and I would find fulfillment in working with the greater Phoenix community and giving something to the community. And then I thought it was an interesting job that I could hopefully do well with my background in business and law. And it turned out to be just that even with the roller coaster ride of everything that's happened in Arizona politics over the last 4 years, it was incredibly meaningful work. And so I feel very lucky.
So do you think you've scratched that itch, or do you think there's something more for you in the future?
Well, the itch has certainly been scratched for the time being. Heavens, it's been overscratched, I dare say. You know, I never know. I'm still sort of involved in the public policy process. I enjoy writing for the Arizona Republic, as I do now.
And, I've seen that.
So I care about politics, and I care about the state of Arizona, and I think it's an interesting conversation, and I just think that we're at an interesting moment in Arizona politics and American politics, really, where we're having some of these very large conversations about sort of what is government's role, the future of American democracy and whatnot, and that's fascinating to me.
So that said, real quick, you're now working as part of the Reimagining Democracy Program at the Ash Center of Democratic Governance and Innovation at the Harvard Kennedy School. What is that going to look like for you, and what's your desired outcome?
Yeah. Well, this was a rare opportunity in my life where I had where I could just put everything down and pack up and go to Cambridge for a time being. So I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I'm already sick of the winter. I am already missing Arizona, even just after 3 weeks of winter here. But we're working on ideas and with students regarding, again, the future of democracy. So things like state electoral reform, national electoral reform, even some of these conversations about should we have documented proof of citizenship requirements for voting in federal elections in the United States, such as are happening right now at the Congress.
Well, that sounds like it's something that I want to talk with you in a lot more depth, but maybe not today. I may have to bring you back, because there's something we definitely want to talk to you about, and that is the challenge and what you learned about off-term elections. We're going to need to take a break right now, and Stephen, I hope you can stay with us. I may ask you to stay beyond the bottom of the hour if you're available as well, so thank you for joining
us.
That's
all right. Sounds good.
All right. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, and I'm joined by Josh Jacobson with me this morning. So, Josh, again, appreciate you sitting in on this last hour since we're going to talk more politics.
Yep. Good morning, everyone.
And we've got Stephen Richard, former Maricopa County recorder, online with us, and he is now the... I just had the newest senior practice fellow in American democracy at the Harvard Kennedy School. So, Stephen, thank you for joining us. And if we can keep you a little bit, a few minutes past the bottom of the hour,
yeah, I'd love absolutely. To do love, I'm at your disposal.
Love to do that as well. And because I've always valued, you've come down several times to Southern Arizona and spoken to predominantly business organizations, but also to a lot of other folks about your view of how our democracy is working and all that. But today I'm going to ask you a special question. We're facing a half-cent sales tax here in the city of Tucson, Prop 414. It was originally going to be on the ballot in August, but the city of Tucson wasn't quite ready to go. And instead of rolling it into November, they decided to wait until March. What have you seen in your time as the county recorder of the reason that a community would roll it into a off-cycle election?
Well, by statute, some elections are allowed to be at different periods of time. And so there are four election dates that an election can be held throughout every year. But generally speaking, if you don't put it on either the July statewide general election, then you're going to have much, much, much lower turnout. Instead of, for instance, in this most recent presidential election, most counties in Arizona had about 75% to 80% of registered voters participated. If you put an election on March, then it'll probably be more like 20% to 25% mm-hmm. of registered voters will participate. And so irrespective of the decision and whatever the reason behind that, the outcome will be just that this half-cent sales tax will be determined by far fewer residents of Pima County.
And personally, I believe that if you are going to put something to the voters, and we always hear, well, we want the voters to decide, we want them to tell us, the citizens to tell us what we want, then having a 20 to 25% turnout is nowhere as significant in excess of 70. So now I'm going to ask you to step out of the box. Historically, why have you seen communities do it that way to drive a lower voter turnout?
Well, I don't know if it's fully backed in all the statistics, but you'll see that some organizations feel that they would stand a better political chance because of who would turn out. Traditionally, the thinking goes is that if you have low turnout, then it's the highly motivated groups, some of the interest groups or somebody who has a particular interest in the specific issue. Oftentimes, public sector unions will have a specific interest in a particular interest who can then make up a higher percentage of the vote. So again, if you go to a November general election and you have, say, the U.S. Senate race on the ballot or the November or the presidential election on the ballot, then people are going to take a look at that. They're going to know. They're going to be excited about their ballot. They're going to open it up, and then they're probably going to see it through to the bitter end. But if they don't know that there's even an election going on, then they might get that in the mail, and they might just put it right in the circular filing bin, as they say, and not participate.
So, Stephen, thanks for that. This is Josh Jacobson. For the listeners, this is no breaking news here, but this is Josh Jacobson's opinion. The reason they're doing it in March, to expand on what Stephen just said, is because the Democratic Party knows that they can turn their people out and they can push this through. That is the big breaking headline here. And if you've lived in Pima County for any period of time or the city of Tucson, you know that's exactly what happens. Stephen, one question for you. And we might have to get this on the other side of the break.
Actually, we're going to do that. Josh, save that question. Yep. Sorry, Steve. We're going to go to the break now since we know you can stay beyond the hour. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We will be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's keeping us on time and on target, as he says, with a shaky hand, but he's doing an incredible job. We could not do this show without Matt behind the glass. I've got Josh Jacobson with me and calling in from nice, balmy, warm, okay, maybe not warm, Cambridge, Massachusetts is Stephen Richard, the former county recorder of Maricopa County. Stephen, I've got a couple, another question or two for you, and I appreciate you staying over. We've got our next guest teed up and ready to go as well. So I'm going to turn it back to Josh Jacobson. I know he's got a question about these special elections.
Yeah, so quick question, Stephen. As Maricopa recorder, you've got Mesa and other communities that are roughly about the same size as Tucson, about 500,000 voters. Do you have any idea of the cost to put on a special election for a community of roughly 500,000 voters in March?
Yeah, it's going to be about $10 per voter. So $10 per registered voter. And so I forget what the numbers are for Tucson right now, but I think it's around 400,000, 300,000, something like that in terms of registered voters, and then it'll be $10. Now, with a special election like this, you usually don't have as many in-person voting locations, but you're going to mail out a mail ballot packet to every single registered voter. So you're going to pay for the printing and the assembling of both the ballot packet, the instructions, and the ballot itself. And then you're going to pay for the return postage for anyone who sends it back. You're also going to set up some of those voting locations. So it means going to be acquiring the sites and paying temporary workers to be working them. And then, of course, you're going to pay for the temporary workers who are going to come in and help you do things like signature verification and ballot processing. So it'll cost a decent chunk of change.
Yeah, that certainly does, especially for a city that's supposedly broke.
And in the city of Tucson, it is all mail-in. So there is no same-day voting. You can drop your ballots off, I believe, at a fewer number of limited sites. But they do it all by mail. But it's still, that means you have to verify all the signatures. There's no ID that's being passed on. Yeah. So there's definitely some costs up there.
Yeah. So if you wanted to save some money, the more things you put on one ballot, the better, because then you have all the federal elections, you have all the state elections, you have all the local elections, and you don't have to mail out a separate ballot packet. Now, again, that's if going back, if you had put it on the November ballot or on the July primary ballot.
And that's a great point. I do believe, I think this final number was approaching 75% in the city of Tucson in the November ballot, which this question, and it is a single question, do you want the city of Tucson to raise sales tax to 9.2%? Single question, you could have had 75% of the population or more vote on it. And this one, last time they had a special election in March, it was 24% that turned out.
Kind of sounds like voter suppression to me, Ted, but that's just my opinion over here.
Well, you know, and again, to the previous point, it really heightens the importance of special interest, because if there's a measure on the ballot that says, you know, everyone in Tucson has to pay a tenth of a cent more in sales tax, but it all goes to redheads, and I'm a redhead, so I really care about this. Well, then it's millions of dollars for each redhead. So we really care, and we sure as heck are going to vote in this election. But maybe the average Tucsonian doesn't care that much, because it's only 0.1 cents. And so maybe they won't turn out, but the people who are benefiting from this or care a lot about it certainly will.
Well, it's very interesting. We've got opposition from both sides, some unique bedfellows, so to speak, when it comes to voting against this. And I'll definitely keep you informed how it turns out, Stephen. I appreciate your time this morning. I'm excited about the work you're going to be doing back at the Ash Center, and I really would like to bring you back on at a later date to talk about some of the specifics of what you're hoping to accomplish.
Oh, of course. I appreciate it, and now I've got it figured out, so next time it'll be easy peasy.
Hey, easy peasy is always good, so thank you, Stephen. I appreciate it. You have a great day.
Thanks,
and Ted. Stay warm.
Thank you.
I'll try. Thanks, guys.
Okay, thank you. All right, so now we're going to be joined by Bruce Wheeler. Bruce, appreciate you calling in.
So real quick, Ted.
Good morning.
Hey, appreciate you. I know you're out of state right now. Otherwise, I think we'd have you in the studio, but definitely want to get something. Josh, you said quick thought.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to actually, this is a great segue into Mr. Wheeler coming on. But, you know, just for the listeners, if you were paying attention to Stephen Richard's math, you know, this special election is going to cost the city right around $3 million if his number of $10 per registered voter is accurate. That's a big chunk of money.
That is, especially when you're trying to ask the voters to give you more money. I think the number may turn out to be a little lower than that just because of the cost associated with, but we don't know. We listen to the experts. So, Bruce, you are a longtime Tucsonan. You've been engaged and involved in the community for a long time. You've been in elected office, both at the state legislature twice, serving, I think, just over 10 years of total service to the state legislature. And more importantly, you've been a member of the city council. So you explored going to CD6, running for Ward 6, and you've decided not to. You've got a lot of experience in community service, and you've given back. You've engaged. What led you to start doing that, and why did at this time did you decide Ward 6 was not where you wanted to run?
Well, segueing into your engagement hour, which as it's called, my engagement was when I taught at Pima College, I told my students, I would say, look, you need to know who your elected officials are. You need to pay attention to politics no matter how disassociated you are or disinterested you are, because you know what? Those politicians decide almost so many important issues that affect each and every single one of us. What schools we go to, what jobs we get, what jobs are available, the quality of the water we drink, the quality of the air we breathe, the taxes we pay, basically war and peace issues. So it's really important to be engaged. And I back you 100%, Ted, in trying to get the public engaged.
Well, I appreciate that. I think I did see, I can't remember if it was your quote, but somebody referenced War and Peace when they made the decision not to run this year. So definite interest. There was a lot of us that I think were looking forward to your challenge and run in Ward 6. You bring a lot of experience. You've been through a lot of it. You've seen a lot of changes. But you've been pretty vocal since you made the announcement you weren't going to run on Ward 6 on Prop 414. And I just want to appreciate you joining us today. I want to give you the opportunity to express your concerns.
Well, absolutely, and thank you for that. You know, when I ran for the city council and was elected in 1987, we had a similar problem with the sense of contaminated drinking water, trichloroethylene in the drinking water. The city was not acknowledging it, was not taking steps. Even the Democratic governor, Bruce Babbitt, was dragging his feet. So several of us got involved. I ran. I won. We cleaned it up. It took a while. We had the Air Force, Hughes at that time, which is now Raytheon, and the city and the state all participate. So we succeeded. Now, this year, 414 obviously is a critical issue, but we're still facing water quality issues. What's the quality of our water? We got a flyer from Tucson Water, the public did, about, I'd say, 2 months ago, which was very confusing, basically scaring us, saying, is there lead in your water? And when I went to the Ward 6 office to ask what this meant, they said, well, you know, it's your responsibility to replace the pipes from the main into your house, and we don't know if those pipes have lead. And I thought, well, that's pretty bad. How long will this take? Several years. So there's quality. It's the availability. Where are we getting our water? What are we going to do with it? You know, I'm a little concerned that our present city attorney, in his previous job, was one of those persons involved in giving away groundwater to Saudi Arabia, and thank God the state stepped in and terminated that. So we still have issues like PEP. The public, I don't know how much the public knows about what's going on behind closed doors, but PEP's concession is up, I think, next year, and the public has an option to either modify the concession contract or even discussion about taking it over so we have a publicly owned electric power company. So what's the involvement of the public in that? Zero so far. It's a major issue. We're excluded right now. Roads, I don't think I have to tell anyone about the condition of our roads. Let's take the bus system. I've been taking the bus for 4 years. Now it's a so-called free fare bus. Well, when I looked into how much we lose in revenue a year, Ted, we lose $13 million a year by providing the so-called free bus,
in the last 4 years, that's well over 40 million. So you talked about a $2 million cost for a special election, which should be tied into, in your previous discussion, to a regular election. So that's $2 million. There's $40 million losing from the bus, a $22 million surplus, and now they want to hit us with a half-cent sales tax to generate $800 million over 10 years, which is $80 million a year. Well, right now, with the surplus, the loss of bus revenue, and who knows what's in the city budget, and who's going to look into the city budget? I say no. This Prop 414, I'm not going to hold back. It's dishonest. It's dishonest toward the people and the citizens and the taxpayers of this community because it's not telling the truth. It's unrealistic. They want a new helicopter, a new fixed-wing plane, and a new engine for another helicopter. Well, I looked into Fresno paid $7 million for an Airbus H-125 police helicopter, plus surveillance equipment. All right, we don't have to pay $7 million. We had LAPD has Bell 206 Jet Rangers. They're in the $1 million range, and plus surveillance equipment. A fixed-wing plane, the cheapest that I could find anywhere, we're all familiar with the Cessna 172, that's at least half a million. So, you know, are we really helping the police department? I really don't think so. And while we're talking about, and they pretend to talk about public safety, let's talk about the fire department. Let's talk about response times. When we have somebody in a home that has a heart attack or any type of emergency that's life-threatening, we call 911. And we, when I was on the city council a long time ago, the response time from the call to 9/11 to the paramedic showing up at your place was 4 minutes. Now it's about 6 minutes.
Mm-hmm. That's Bruce, just for the listeners, real quick, you just mentioned that you were on the city council. Could you remind the listeners when you were on the city council? And you did bring up the budget. I have looked at the budget, and when you were on the city council, I bet you did too. I'm wondering if you've looked at the budget recently.
Yeah. Well, as much as I as we're allowed to try looking into it, they'll send you this gobbledygook. But
that was going to be my point. Thank you.
I was elected in 87. I served two terms, so I left in 95. The city budget in 95 was around $800 million. Today, it's about $2.2 billion. The Tucson Police Department had 1,200 police officers in 1995.
Thank you.
Today we 800
and 720 deployable actually, and we're getting ready to go to break here, so just want to point out for the listeners, listen to what Bruce Wheeler is saying. This is a guy that has been there, he's done that, he's got experience, he knows what he's talking about. And Ted, we're gonna hang on to Mr. Wheeler over the break. Is
absolutely I there's been some standing ovations in the studio based on Bruce, your comments. So I look forward to talking to you on after this break. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell. I'm joined by Josh Jacobson in the studio. And we've got Bruce Wheeler on the line. Bruce, appreciate the bluntness and the honesty in your voice. That is not being heard enough. City council member from 1987 to 1995. You pointed out the number of line officers we had back then to compare to what we have now. Prop 414, while it assigns more positions to the roles, it doesn't guarantee hiring. There was an article in the paper the other day that said they have 24 vacancies. That's patently false. They're closer to 100 vacancies. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in the 80s, 90s, I've heard as high as 110. But that is a challenge for them to get people there. Bruce, you were a strong, traditional Democratic representative. I believe, what ward did you represent at that time?
Ward 1 on the west side.
Okay, so you were Ward 1 on the west side.
Yeah.
Things have taken a change since then. That's why I think some people were invigorated by your voice possibly coming back in. What is the responsibility of the council when it comes to funding and their funding priorities?
Well, of course, in any city, state, federal, it's the people's security and safety. In the city's case, it's that. And that's why I'm really hung up on this paramedic, fire department, and response time. Our fire department is overextended. Our response time saving people's lives has been going downhill from 4 minutes 30, 40 years ago when I was there to 6 minutes now. That's unacceptable. If we care about lives, we should be addressing at least those two issues. But the fire department needs ladders. It needs engines. It needs a lot of support. And 414 is unrealistic and dishonest, again, because it's not addressing that. I forgot the total number of new police officers that would be hired, but I think it's 30. I could be wrong about that.
They call out 40 for certified police officers.
That's a drop in the bucket,
right?
Obviously. So then they talk about this community corridor tool. That's new language for who knows what. We can spend an hour on what that is and how many millions we're going to spend on that and how that's going to help people. It's not going to help the homeless. It's not going to help the police department. It's not going to help the fire department or response times for people that call 911. And those are the responsibilities of the city. The roads, my gosh, we belong to the RTA that spends, I don't know how many tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, and the city of Tucson, the biggest contributor to that fund, receives a disproportionately inferior amount of money to what the other jurisdictions in RTA do, and we only have one vote equal to every other Oro Valley and Marana and all the others. I think that's unjust. And, you know, let me tell you, when we were on the council, we had a majority. We got four votes to do something that you've never probably, a lot of your listeners have probably never heard of. We fired the city manager and we fired the fire chief. The city manager lied to us. We fired him. The fire chief, the firefighters collected amongst themselves, I forgot the exact number, but something like 90%+ of all firefighters signed a paper saying they had no confidence in the fire chief because he was doing the bidding of the city manager. This is how it works. And the city manager told the fire chief, you don't need new ladders, you don't need new engines, and you don't need all this stuff. And we all knew that we did need all those things. So we fired the fire chief. And if where's
Bruce, I got a quick question for you since you're talking about first responders, and I can tell, you know, that you have a ton of admiration for our first responders that are on the job. But one question I do have is, how do you feel about the city parading our first responders out in front of this proposition the way that they have and have made them the actual face for it? Lisa Lavallo described it as sending them out with a tin cup, I believe, to be fodder, political fodder for this. You know, as a former elected, how does that kind of sit with you?
It kind of pisses me off. I'm sorry that our people are being used like that. It's shameful.
So on that note, Bruce, I know that we're running out of time, and I'm going to give the mic back to Ted, but I heard that you dropped out because of the race because you wanted to spend more time reading War and Peace. Well, I'm a Republican here, and I would offer to buy you the Cliff Notes to War and Peace so you could get through that and get back into the race and keep sharing these opinions because this needs to be heard, sir.
It needs to be heard, and, you know, I appreciate the offer. It's a combination of things. You know, I have grandchildren. I have other things to do with my life. I travel. I do photography. I love my life. I love what I'm doing. I love Tucson. And I just hope someone that, you know, more people step up. And like you said in your hour, it's an engagement of the public. And I think we should get over having to expect politicians to agree on everything, you know. I was a Democrat when I was in office, and then I registered as an independent. I was an independent until 2 weeks ago so that I could run for city council. Obviously, I'm going back to being an independent because I think, in my case, the Democratic Party is completely out of touch with the public. In this last election, the presidential nominee had no message to the American people. And so I think the Democratic Party is just in a real mess where it's lost its bearings, it's lost its leadership, it's lost its message. And hopefully we can get back to the things that unite us. For instance, again, back to response times. Paramedics to me is a big deal. Response time is a big deal. And we all want the same things. We all love our children, no matter what party we belong to. We want housing, jobs, security, schools, health care. Let's do it.
And Bruce, we're up against the clock. I also want to point out the police response time for their critical, aka you're physically being harmed, call-ins is also at 6 minutes. We need to say no. We've had enough. Focus on the men and women that serve. Thank you for your call. Be safe, travel safe, and everybody, you've been listening to The Morning Voice.